Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's special St. Patrick's Day show. In the past, we've celebrated St. Patrick's Day in a lighthearted manner, taking a whimsical look at how Americans celebrate the day, as well as by pausing for more sober reflections on the history of Ireland and Irish immigrants to the United States. Today, we're going to take a look at the history of the current troubles in Northern Ireland and prospects for peace. But before we do that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. This week in 1493, one of the world's most daring and controversial explorers returned to his home port after discovering a new world. Christopher Columbus, the Italian navigator that sailed for Spain, thought he had accomplished what many believed could not be done, reaching the Orient by sailing west from Europe. What he did not realize and would never realize during his lifetime was that he had stumbled on the shores of a land known only in legend to the peoples of Europe. 13 years, 3 more voyages, and a failed attempt at governing later, Columbus died a broken and largely forgotten, but not poor, man. Turning to items of interest in the news, a religious icon of Russian Tsar Nicholas II is being examined by Russian church officials to determine just how and why it seems to be producing tears. The icon has been leaking myrrh, a gum resin, almost every day since it was brought to the church by a parishioner last November 7th, the anniversary date of the 1917 Russian Revolution. According to Orthodox tradition, the appearance of such fragrant liquids could be considered a miracle, and if that's the case, the Russian Orthodox Church may make the Tsar a saint, something it's been considering for some time now. And in Yucatan, a pile of ancient human bones dating back to the 4th or 5th century is revealing the bloody dark side of Maya history. Uncovered by archaeologist David Friedel, the jumble of human remains is further evidence of nearly 9 centuries of violence and competition for leadership among a people who believe their kings to be divine. The bones being examined are of just such a king and his blood relatives. Their ritualistic torture and murder, peculiar burial, and accompanying artifacts all open new doors of inquiry into the beliefs and pursuits of an ancient people long honored for what was believed to have been their peaceful and humane ways. You're listening to Talking History. For 8 centuries, Ireland has been a divided land in which neighbor has been pitted against neighbor, at times reaching levels of violence that approximate a state of civil war, at other times lapsing into an uneasy calm. The most recent troubles in Northern Ireland began in the late 1960s and have continued down to the present, taking the lives of an estimated 3,000 people, and still the problem has not been resolved. Last year, a ray of hope appeared when a majority of the Irish people endorsed a plan for peace, the Belfast Agreement. But given the history of the struggle in Northern Ireland, what are the prospects for peace? Here from London to give us his thoughts on the matter is Sean McDougall. McDougall is a research fellow at the Institute of Contemporary British History at the University of London, where he specializes in Northern Irish affairs. He's the editor of the Northern Ireland Question in British Politics, published in the United States by St. Martin's Press, and a frequent contributor to the BBC, the Times of London, and a number of American newspapers. Welcome, Sean, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In my introduction, I made a note to the centuries-old history of this problem in Northern Ireland. Obviously, we don't have time to review it all, but what would you have us remember from that period, let's say prior to 1922?
Prior to 1922, the Irish nationalists believed that the island was subjected to wave after wave of foreign invader, beginning with Normans and Vikings, and then Scots and English. And over the centuries, that kind of influx of people were continually treated as foreigners. They were either assimilated or repelled. So the 800 years of war that you mentioned were ones in which an Irish nation were opposed to foreigners trying to defend their culture. Although that would be disputed by some other people who would say that the Irish nation itself was so primitive as not really not to be able to call itself a nation. And consequently, what you actually have are migrant patterns of movement of Normans and Scots and Irish people moving around Ireland as well. But in the late 19th century, the belief system that existed then was a bit more simple than the one we have now. Consequently, it was a case of us against them, and that's what motivated people when they made their decisions at that time.
And your reference to them, has that been more closely focused on transplanted, let's say, Englishmen and Scots in Ireland?
Well, those people were born in Ireland and arrived in Ireland before people arrived in North America. But there is a strand within Irish nationalist belief which still continues to treat them as foreign. And that's because the culture and politics which they espouse are pro-British rather than pro-independent Irish, if you like. And they themselves, you know, can't help where they were born. But nationalists would still regard them as being of foreign bloodstock in a very simplistic manner, not really one of us, even though they've been present for centuries.
Okay. How did the creation of the two states in Ireland between 1920 and 22 impact on this?
Well, it would be seen by some as a recognition of the fact that there were two nations in Ireland, and by others as just the latest tactic in a war conducted by outside forces on the Irish people. If you take the first interpretation, Northern Ireland was created because a majority of the people who lived there felt very happy within the United Kingdom, being British, being part of the British Empire, and wanted to continue to be so. Whereas on the other side of the border, a majority of people were opposed to the very same things and wanted to have an independent Irish state. If you take the second view that this was a tactical strategy, then Northern Ireland was created because the British were no longer able to maintain complete control over Ireland, and it signifies the fact that they were partially but not completely pushed out of the island.
In the situation of Northern Ireland, are we talking here about a contest of cultures, or perhaps an attempt on one or the other to weaken the other culture?
I think that the two communities have, by and large, coexisted, but flashpoints, you know, exist where they have been intermingled. For instance, when you look in the newspapers today and they're reporting that the Orange Order is trying to march down a particular street and they're being opposed, it's probably because over the years the proportion of nationalists who live in that street has risen to a point where instead of being seen as tolerable, it's now being seen as intolerable to have unionists marching down playing their drums. But 20 years ago it would probably have been seen as a festive occasion rather than a confrontation. The real problem is not that the two communities have to get on with each other. It's the fact that a minority within each community refuses to do what everybody else has done. And they have looked outside of their place, either to the British government or to the Irish government, to back them up in what they're doing. So, for instance, a minority of Irish nationalists form the core of the IRA, and it's conducting a guerrilla campaign, for want of a better term, and its aspiration is to create a united Ireland with a single Irish government. And on the other side, there are loyalist paramilitaries who are opposed to the IRA. They are a minority amongst the unionist community, and they're intent on imposing their will and looking to a British government to support their aspiration to remain part of the United Kingdom.
You may want to come back to that idea of the minorities driving this. That's a good point. But let me just step back a moment. You mentioned flashpoints and periods of calm. Clearly a flashpoint that has been lasting is whatever happened in the late 60s to cause the current problems. Could you briefly review what led to the problems that developed at that time period?
Well, the 1960s was a time when people who were born just after the Second World War reached adulthood. And as you may be aware, immediately after the Second World War, the British government created what they called the welfare state, which guaranteed free education even to university level. So by the 1960s, we had a very sharp change in direction because for the first time, ordinary people from unionist and nationalist communities had a chance of being educated to degree level. And they believed it was wrong to continue with the old system of very, very class-based, very much a sense of separate communities and a factory that would tend to employ just Protestants or a factory that would just employ Catholics. They thought that opportunity mattered more, equality of opportunity mattered more than anything else. So they began to march, and they were trying to take a stand. I suppose they would have liked to be compared to Martin Luther King's civil rights marchers in America. The problem was that the IRA, which had been largely defunct up to that point, saw the opportunity to create a conflict and resurrect itself, and it succeeded in doing so by taking over the civil rights group. And within a year of its formation, the IRA was effectively back at work. And from there, we had a spiraling downwards, downward spin with 3,000 people being killed so far. And what's happening at the moment is an attempt to allow everybody to get out of the hole that we've dug ourselves into.
That reference to the American Civil Rights Movement is certainly something that's been played up on this side of the Atlantic. A recent television documentary tried to draw parallels between what was happening in the 50s and 60s in the United States and the movement in Northern Ireland. So you do, in fact, see some parallels there?
I see some parallels. I mean, I know a lot more about the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association than I do about the American one. But I would... I'm afraid as an expert in Irish history, although I don't like to use the phrase myself, but if that's what I am, I tend to see the superficialities and the complexities within. So, for instance, that although they, on a superficial level, they bear comparison, I know that the Civil Rights Association in Northern Ireland was fairly badly organised. Easy to take over, and it was, for instance, it had an entirely democratic framework to the point that it didn't have an organizing committee. It did not have an agenda. Meetings were open, and people could just speak on whatever they wanted to. So in that sense, it was very easy for organized militants to take over, and I'm not sure whether that was the same case in the American equivalent bodies.
The event, the problems we just spoke of, late 60s, early 70s, probably the most significant event, certainly emotionally, is this Bloody Sunday, which many people associate with really the entrance or the suspension of home rule, so to speak, and the entrance of English rule, which again in this documentary was suggested that this in fact made the war into an English war. How do you respond to that?
Well, I can understand that point of view. To sum up Bloody Sunday for your listeners, there was a British Army regiment in a city called Londonderry, and by the end of the day, 14 innocent people had been killed. And the subsequent inquiries, which have continued even to the present day, do seem to confirm now that those people were not actually confronting the army in any way that would threaten life. So in other words, a lethal response was absolutely inappropriate. And the significance of that act is that it was not the Northern Ireland government controlling security. It was a British army regiment, which was under the control of the British government. And so in that sense, it was many Republicans who view this sense of outsiders coming in and engaging in conflict in Ireland. They can draw a straight line backwards through history. So this is another example of the British army coming in and just killing Irish people. Now, obviously, things are a lot more complicated than that, but on a superficial level, those facts fit a superficial reading of history as well.
Okay, well, we're down to just a few moments, so we better turn to the Belfast Agreement. Now, what strikes me about this is the overwhelming numbers, certainly a great majority of the Irish people voting in favor of this. Should we be optimistic given that vote?
I think I would like to be optimistic that 71% of the people in Northern Ireland said yes, 95% of the people in the Irish Republic said yes. So if you claim to act in the name of the people of Ireland, you have to bear in mind that 88% of all people who lived in Ireland are now opposed to violence and have registered that fact. And yet the weapons are still being retained for use in the future. And organisations are still planning and targeting individuals, you know, getting security gathering, recruiting. So in that sense, there's, you know, there's room for optimism because the public voice was so overwhelming. There's pessimism because the organizations have so far ignored that a public voice. But I think that if any organization did attempt to carry on alone, it would face such a concerted crackdown that it could not sustain its campaign for long. And that would be a marked departure from the past.
You certainly made the point, and I want to emphasize it again earlier, about how this has, in a sense, been driven by minorities all along. Is it possible, then, that the minorities could disrupt this whole process?
Well, they certainly tried the bomb at Omagh, which killed 29 people and injured something like 300 people. And amongst the dead were children, pregnant women, and Spanish tourists who happened to be there. This was an atrocity which no person with, you know, whether they're unionist or nationalist, no person had any sympathy with. So they made the attempt, and it didn't work. People stayed committed to the peace process. What we have to do is bear in mind that within the minority, there is a minority who will carry on forever until they are defeated. But the larger number of those people are attempting at the moment to extricate themselves from conflict. And if we can get through the next few months and perhaps into next year, there's a very good chance that this agreement will survive and that the people of Northern Ireland will move forward in peace.
In just a couple words, are you personally optimistic?
I would answer that question on the 10th of March. I think the next few weeks are very, very crucial. But I myself am ever so slightly an optimist at the moment.
And we'll remain optimistic for St. Patrick's Day. So we're out of time. Thank you, Sean, for joining us. It was a very good talk. You've been listening to Sean McDougall, Research Fellow at the Institute of Contemporary British History at the University of London. And this is Talking History. In keeping with our celebration of St. Patrick's Day, we have a special treat for our listeners, poet Eamon Wall. Irish by birth, Wall is professor of English and director of Creighton University's Irish Summer School. He's the author of two widely praised books of poetry, Dykeman 200th Street and Iron Mountain. Two more of Wall's books will appear next year, Truth or Consequences, another collection of poems, and From the Chennai to the Black Hills, a book of essays on Irish America. Today, in a departure from our usual fare, Eamon Wall will read to us two of his poems about his hometown of Enniscorthy, County Wexford, poems which recreate Wall's feelings of a happy childhood.
Rooftops and Illusions. I sweep a flat space among the many level sloping roofs of this gray town. Slate and felt, cars parked from St. Aidan's down Main Street. I hear on the wire that Jesus will save us, that the cathedral restorations are simply gorgeous. In her studio on the Market Square, Mrs. Carty fills in the edges of a photo the camera lost from scratchings in her lap. Communion girls, blue skies, deep red missiles, puffs of cloud. Wildflowers are growing out of the walls. The gutters are weighted with moss. White dots on the gray crown of the Athenaeum, the domino roofs of Slaney Street. I touch your knees and smell your breath as blood flows from your orifices into the Slaney. You whisper, "Dissolution, departed children." At 17, I lay in bed hearing prayers under bunting and bridges, reading down all the days. I was thinking about the walkers stuck on the hills in white dresses and sashes, waiting for the marching to resume, so I might continue with the rhythm of my reading. To know, I suppose, one day I have longed forever to describe to you. Childhood was a day when only the surfaces counted, when we found the goalposts in murky water near the mill field and made plans for retrieving them, when we stripped in the heavy night air under wild fuchsia and stars and watched cars come and go on the Wexford Road. We are easily replaced and forgotten, so skies and rivers are what we have learned to call discourse. I am one man, you need to know this, gray rooftop and water, undissolved by absence, crossing the old bridge from the Shannon to the other side of town. Mount Leinster and Me. I want the day to continue to divide, to be the pool. A train that has arrived, a puff of smoke on the way to another town. So what I see is not some poem, but the mountain I have seen before, gray-skinned, cracked, older than me, an aging slice of a mysterious soul in County Wexford, where I once saw from the feather in its cap the surrounding countryside and Carlow, a splash of smoke in the air. Mountains and dividing worlds, houses dotted on a landscape, widening arms of conifers. The world grows larger. The mountain is there as I saw it as a child.
You've been listening to poet Eamon Wall, author of Dykeman 200th Street and Iron Mountain. For our special St. Patrick's Day show, we've chosen for our site of the week one of Ireland's oldest and most interesting historic sites, Newgrange in County Meath. Here to tell you about Newgrange is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Newgrange is probably one of the most famous of all Irish prehistoric monuments. Originally built about 3100 BC, the passage tomb is much restored. The site was discovered accidentally in 1699 when crews were removing material for road metalling. The Newgrange is built upon a small hillock, and the stone and turf mound is about 280 feet in diameter and 44 feet high, and it contains a passageway that leads to a burial chamber. Above the entrance is a roof box, which aligns precisely with the rising sun at the winter solstice. Rays from the sun touch the ground at the very center of the tomb for about 20 minutes on that day. It is a fascinating site to visit, with more than 30 prehistoric monuments and standing stones in that 3-square-mile area of the Boyne Valley.
Thank you, Cindy. As an additional site on this side of the Atlantic, I might add the Irish American Heritage Museum in East Durham, New York. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, and call to your attention the 3rd Annual Southern Illinois Festival of Irish Music and Dance, which will be held on April 30th and May 1st on the square in downtown Carbondale, Illinois. In addition to the performance of music and dance, the festivities will include a music and dance workshop, arts and crafts demonstrations, a Celtic spirituality workshop, films, and much more. Contact the Carbondale, Illinois Convention and Tourism Bureau for further details. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on the history of the American Census, a regularly scheduled event now over 200 years old that has nevertheless become the source of considerable controversy. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.